Hi, Ben. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're currently leaving clinical medicine behind, and your stethoscope or your hammer, as you might call it in the ortho world, and you're joining as a leadership at Commons Clinic. Tell me about your path and how did you get here?
Right. So, yeah, I've been in practice for 17 years, orthopedic surgery, joint replacements. So, a lot of hammering and sawing and malleting things into place. Very typical standard career for probably the first at least 10, 11 years for that career. And then, about 6, 7 years ago, got interested in entrepreneurship, healthcare technology, got involved in some value-based care stuff in my own practice, and just kind of got to the point in my career where started to think about, what's next? What's my legacy? Am I going to do this forever, or is there something more to my career? And so started doing some angel investing, some advising with some companies, started to build a network by posting stuff on LinkedIn just to kind of drive conversations, get in front of people I wouldn't otherwise get in front of. And that led me to a guy called Nick Aubin, who's the CEO and founder of Commons Clinic. And what Commons Clinic was doing and is still doing was trying to build value-based care models, tech-forward models of care, like a new care delivery model surfaced or revolving around MSK initially, but with the goal to do multi-specialty at some point. So I had come up with this, what I thought was a brilliant idea of arthritis centers of excellence, where you get high quality surgeons, you try to work with instead of against insurance companies, you incorporate technology into what you're doing, you revolve it around outpatient centers and ASCs. And so I wrote this white paper. I put together this slide deck, but I had no idea at the time, like, well, what do I do with this? I didn't know how to get in front of investors. I was in full-time practice. I didn't really have the time to, kind of pursue it. And then came across Commons Clinic, and it turned out that they were already doing or building what I had kind of envisioned. And so met Nick, made a small angel investment in their seed round. This was probably 3 or 4 years ago, and just kept in contact with him through the years. We would touch base every so often, trade notes, just riff on value-based MSK. Started my own blog about 2 years ago, just to kind of share more long-form thoughts. And a lot of it was in line with still what Commons was doing, not necessarily intentionally, but just because we're pretty aligned on the thought process. So Nick reached out to me a year ago, said, "Hey, would you consider bringing your blog under our banner?" I said, "Sure." Along with that, started doing some ad hoc clinical consulting with their team here and there. And that just kind of grew from there. It became kind of this organic thing of they seem to like me, I like them, seem to be a good fit. And it really kind of became where I saw my career evolving to in terms of what I want my impact to be, how can I have impact on a higher, broader scale, larger scale, and what do I find fulfilling? And 17 years is a very fulfilling career. I'm proud of what I did in orthopedic surgery. I feel like I'm leaving at the height of my career, and I think that's important to me to, not be running away from my clinical career, but to be running towards something that I think can be more impactful and as fulfilling, if not more fulfilling, depending on, how successful we are.
What do you think you'll miss the most about your clinical career, and what are some things you won't miss?
I think the thing I'll miss the most, particularly with joint replacements, part of the reason, big part of the reason I decided to go into hip and knee replacements was you're solving a problem, right? You see arthritis on an X-ray, somebody comes in, they're debilitated by it. In the span of a whatever hour-long operation, you cut it out. That's it, the arthritis is gone. They can never get arthritis again. The recovery for some might be longer than others, but you're really curing arthritis. Maybe kind of crude, but it's the best we have, and it works pretty well. And so I like that concrete part of it. I like the fact that you can take somebody that's debilitated and really restore their quality of life. Orthopedics is not usually life-threatening things, but it is function, it's limb, it's and so taking somebody that came limping into your clinic in pain, that can't do whatever, play golf, play with their grandkids, play pickleball, work, whatever it is. And then you do surgery on them, and 2 weeks later they come in and they're walking better, they're off crutches, they're getting their quality of life back. That's very satisfying. That part of the job is very satisfying. So I'll miss that. What I won't miss probably is, really just the frustrations I think that have crept in for everybody in healthcare on the front lines. And EMR gets blamed a lot. That's a part of it. But I think it's really death by a thousand cuts. I think it's EMR, it's regulations, it's reimbursement, it's insurance issues, it's staffing issues on the front lines because there's turnover and because there's understaffing and there's cuts everywhere. And so those things over time kind of really add up. And there's only so much that, as I found out, I think you can do within the system. People are trying, but you run up against so many roadblocks that it just seemed like the only way to really make any headway was to kind of, step outside of that and take a role like Commons, where you're really trying to build, not from outside, but from a little bit of a different perspective. I mean, Commons are the people that started Commons, Nick, Aubin, and Paulo, are not outsiders. They come from healthcare. They're not physicians, but they built in healthcare before. So they're not outsiders. They understand the healthcare issues.
You said as you were working as an orthopedic surgeon, you felt like you needed to do something different. And maybe I'm putting my experience in yours a little bit here. Tell me a bit more about what sparked that entrepreneurship curiosity. And is that something you think is innate, or is that something that can be learned?
I think it's innate. I think it might be latent for a lot of people. In healthcare, it's pretty prescriptive, right? You go to college, you go to medical school, you go to residency, you go to fellowship. I mean, that's the typical track. Then you go out into practice. So there's not a whole lot in that process that's necessarily entrepreneurship focused. I think if you're in private practice, you are running a small business. So in a sense, you are an entrepreneur. I think even if you're employed, you are managing your schedule, you are managing your RVUs, whatever it is. So there is some form of entrepreneurship involved in that. So I think it's innate in us, but it's latent. And I think you just have to kind of uncover that. For me, it was getting to a point in my career where the day-to-day became, I don't want to say easy because it's never easy. The day-to-day became more predictable, though. I kind of knew how to prepare for each day. I knew what I needed to do to be prepared for the OR. I knew what I needed to do to be prepared for clinic. And so that part of it kind of slowed down for me, and it freed up more mental capacity to start thinking about other things. And on top of that, I was experiencing things sort of in my own career on the day-to-day that I felt like, this could be done better. And let me figure out, are there ways to do it? Are there people that are already trying to do that? And that kind of brought me to the entrepreneur world of where are the people that are trying to fix these problems? What are the solutions that they're trying to bring?
Let's talk about arthritis a little bit more. So I'm a family physician. I see quite a few patients, and I do my own joint injections. There's been a lot of advancements at the edges that really haven't taken hold in the medical community. PRP and stem cells, and back in the day, prolotherapy, which is kind of out of favor now. What are your thoughts on, what is next in terms of arthritis treatment? Is it just, and maybe you have a different brand name there. Here it's Synvisc or Nuvisc, which is hyaluronic acid, cortisone and joint replacement, and then Tylenol, Advil. Is that kind of the all we need to know about arthritis? And if not, what's more, and what's the future of arthritis care?
Yeah, I think that's still the tried and true, or still a lot of it. We've tried all these things. We have hyaluronic acid here. It's not covered by some of the insurance companies because the data on it is mixed at best. Still do a lot of cortisone shots, still do NSAIDs, although fewer and fewer patients are really candidates for NSAIDs for whatever reason. They're on blood thinners, they have gastric issues, they have liver or kidney issues, and arthroplasty. So, we've thrown a lot of things at joints and arthritis, and not a lot of them had staying power for whatever reason. And joint replacements ultimately are, I think, the best, most predictable long-term cure. I think Hopefully, we can get better at preventing arthritis. I don't think you can prevent all of it, but I think there are certain things that we can do to maybe decrease the incidence of arthritis. First of all, there's nerve stimulation or nerve blocks and things like that that are coming along as pain relieving types of procedures. There's always companies working on injectables or things that try to support cartilage. I don't think there's any that have made it past like the trial phase that have gotten out into mainstream usage. I think we're getting better, maybe with detecting arthritis earlier, whether it's through advanced MRI imaging or analyzing synovial fluid to see if there are markers of early joint breakdown that maybe you can intervene a little bit earlier. I think someday we'll either have gene therapy where we'll rearrange your genes and you won't get arthritis at all. Or maybe we'll be able to 3D print cartilage on a joint, or do better with cartilage restoration. We've tried those things; it's been mixed success. But somebody that's got advanced arthritis is beyond that point. So, will we someday be able to open somebody's knee up and just kind of 3D print a cartilage matrix or cartilage on the ends of the bone? Possibly, maybe in my lifetime. Maybe in my lifetime we'll have gene therapy to kind of prevent arthritis in the first place. But I don't think there's anything on the immediate horizon that's going to take the place of joint replacement for the patient with advanced arthritis.
It sounds like your transition out of clinical medicine was more inspired by finding something to run forward to, as you said. A lot of my colleagues, and to an extent, me myself, our transition is running away from clinical medicine. Why do you think physicians are burning out? And did you burn out? And if you didn't, what protected you from burning out?
Yeah, I think there was definitely times where I had symptoms of burnout. I don't know that I ever fully burnt out, but there were definitely times where it felt like, you would show up and you would do your job and you didn't feel like you were, making the impact that you intended to make when you got into healthcare. And that can be very frustrating. It can be very, very deflating, because this is a challenging job. It's a stressful job. It's a job that you put a lot of your life into, and it's more than a job. I think it is a career that isn't just a 9 to 5. So for me, it really was getting involved in the entrepreneurship and realizing that I think some of the burnout, or a lot of the burnout, maybe comes from thinking that you're hopeless and helpless in a situation, right? There's just nothing you can do about it. You show up every day and these problems exist, and you're kind of shouting into the void or banging your head up against the wall. And I think that, more than anything, can be extremely frustrating for people to feel like, you have no agency, you have no ability to change anything. And getting involved in entrepreneurship and being around people that, some are grifting, some are in it for the wrong reasons, but a lot of them aren't. And being around people that maybe don't always 100% understand what the problems are, but have an earnest interest in trying to solve them was refreshing. And then taking what I had learned from being on the front lines, my frontline experience, and being able to translate that to people that were building in healthcare, but maybe didn't have a great grip on what was going on the front lines was satisfying. It kind of showed me that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There is somebody out there like Nick Aubin and Commons Clinic that are bringing high level, get your hands dirty solutions to healthcare. And that was very satisfying to me, building a network and community online, starting to write and really kind of express those opinions and have it resonate with people. All of those things, I think, really helped me kind of stave off that burnout and gave me renewed hope. I think that's tough. I think it takes time. It takes some risk to put yourself out there or get involved in some of these things. And so I don't think it's necessarily easy for everybody. It wasn't easy for me. And so I think you kind of get trapped in this cycle that you don't feel like there's any way out of. And I think that's why a lot of people in this day and age are kind of burning out. I think there is a light at the end of the tunnel. I think it's going to take some time. I think things are cyclical. So I'm hopeful that at some point, not just through Commons Clinic, but in general, things get better on the front lines for the people that are delivering the care. And it's not just doctors, it's nurses, it's physical therapists, it's case managers. I think just about everybody that touches a patient has experienced that.
What would 20-year-old Ben think of where you are today, both in terms of your personal life and your professional life?
I think personal life, he'd be pretty happy. I mean, look, I can't complain. I have a great family. I've had success in my career. Not just in clinical medicine, but some of the things I've done, outside of it, side gig wise. So, I live a very good life, and I've been very fortunate in that way. So, I think he'd be happy with where he was personally. I think professionally, I think it would depend if he knew the journey it would take to get there. I think he'd be like, oh, yeah, that's going to be, a journey, residency, and fellowship, and early in your career struggles, and then making that pivot towards more leadership, entrepreneur type of stuff. I think if he saw the end result, he would be pretty happy and hopefully proud of future Ben, because I'm really excited about where I've been, but also where I'm going.
I don't know if you have kids, and if so, how old they are. How old are your kids?
So I have two daughters, 14, who'll be in high school next year, and 12.
Okay. So I have two daughters, 12 and 5. If your daughters came to you and they said they would like to become an orthopedic surgeon, what would your response be?
Yeah, I'm not one of those doctors that's like, oh, you'd be crazy, don't go into, healthcare or whatever. I mean, look, at the core of it, when you strip away all the stuff that makes it less appealing, it's still a great profession. Unfortunately, I think we've lost a lot of what makes being a doctor great. But I think at the core of it, it's still there, and you still have those moments. Like I was saying before, when you take that person that could barely walk when you first met them, some of them are even in wheelchairs or on walkers, and they come in and you've changed their lives. And some of them will tell you, look, you changed my life. That's extremely rewarding, and I think that's as close to a superpower as you can get. It isn't always like that, clearly, but I think when it is, it's very rewarding. I think I wish those moments were more common than they are now. So I would never, my approach when it comes to that is, do what you find fulfilling. I'm here to guide you. If you're interested in being an orthopedic surgeon, I'm there with you every step of the way. I would never, let my own experience dissuade them from doing it. I would guide them and share my experiences, but I would never, tell them don't do it because X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, I've been. I think if you ask physicians within, and I'm kind of just crossing the 8 year mark out of post residency. If you ask physicians around the 5, 6 year mark post residency, they will all say we would never want our kids to be physicians. And then as you get more experience about other fields and how things work, you tend to get a better appreciation of how strong of a factor that immediate reward we get from our patients is. And how rare it is in other fields and other jobs to be congratulated every day and multiple times a day.
The grass is always greener, and the highs can be very high and the lows can be very low. And yeah, I think that 5 to 6 year mark, you're not wide-eyed anymore, you're experienced, and then I think you start to feel the weight of some of that. But if you can get past that period, I think you learn to be a little bit easier on yourself, a little bit less perfectionistic, and realize that it's not always going to be perfect, but at the end of the day, if you're doing the best you can, and most patients are doing well, then you, I think, have to resist the tendency to be too hard on yourself.
Do you think you live a balanced life? And this is coming from someone who has no balance in his life, and it's not a good thing, right? Because I work too much, and I'm programmed to just work, and it's hard to undo that programming. Do you think you have that kind of inherent drive to work all the time? And if so, how do you offset that?
Yeah, I think I have the drive. I think a lot of doctors have that drive. And so I've tried to be mindful. I was in full-time clinical practice. I basically had almost a full-time side gig job, but my responsibility while I was in practice was always to my patients. They came first, and then this other stuff was after hours, on weekends, between surgeries, at lunch, whatever it was. And then you have to be careful about stripping away all your free time and finding that balance. I mean, I found the side gig work to be fulfilling, and I found it to be, they talk about work-life harmony instead of work-life balance, and that means that some of the stuff, if you're working all the time, as long as it's sort of in harmony with your life and not just work all the time, or doesn't feel like work all the time, is less taxing. But I definitely had to learn how to kind of pull back and say no to things, or okay, it's time to shut it off. It's family time, and it's time to get away from it, because I think that can also obviously lead to burnout if you're not taking enough time just to kind of give yourself a break.
There seems to be a growing divide between leadership and healthcare, especially in hospitals and health systems, and frontline physicians. What do you think is the reason for that divide? And if you could change one thing about both camps, what would you change?
I think the divide in part is because there's just become so many layers within a hospital or a health system. And my dad was a hospital administrator growing up. This was the 1980s and early 90s, and things were different back then. There weren't like these multiple layers between him as the administrator, the CEO of the hospital, and the doctors. There was a very close connection, for better or worse, because some of them could be kind of tough. Doctors could be kind of tough. But now I feel like we have so many layers between like what happens on the front lines and in the C-suite. I wish, CEOs, and now you have these big hospitals and health systems where the CEO of the health system might be, three towns over, and never even comes to the community hospital and really has a great grasp of what goes on the front line. So I wish administrators, the people that really are at the top making the decisions, spent more time on the front lines to understand, what the challenges are, because you don't get that looking at spreadsheets or sitting in meetings all day. You have to actually be in there experiencing it. I think from a physician perspective, I think we've now developed this muscle where it's automatic, like conflict when we're dealing with administrators, and understand they're part of it too. They have boards that they're answering to, the bottom line, and they're responsible for fiscal results and things like that. And some of the things are out of their control in terms of regulations that are coming down from the government, from JCO, from the state, whatever it is. So I think there's a middle ground there to realize that, maybe look at it from each other's perspective a little bit more to have better understanding.
What's something you've changed your mind on in the past couple of years?
Think probably the biggest thing is I was pretty skeptical about this whole body MRI and lab work and wellness and prevention type of thing. Like, that's snake oil. I think a lot of it still is, but I've come around on the idea of done appropriately, early detection and having this more comprehensive lab work and really a deep dive in your health once a year or once every 5 years or whatever it is, does make some sense. I think there's still the key of separating the signal from the noise, not chasing every lab value that's slightly out of range or every incidental OMA. But I do think that there is a place for moving upstream a little bit, doing a better job servicing these things. Here in the US, I think your primary care has just been so compressed because of poor reimbursement, because patients are so complicated these days, and because there's just not enough, time to spend with people, that we don't get as deep a dive as maybe we should into some of these things. And a lot of it, insurance companies may not necessarily pay for, because they can't see the, some actuaries telling them it's not worth it. So yeah, this whole idea of prevention, early detection, I've started to come around on.
And do you have any thoughts on how we deal with the primary pushback we get on whole body MRIs is incidental OMAs, and how we deal with them? Do you think that is a valid concern, or do you think it's, we are the guinea pig generation for longevity and more for focus on preventive health?
Yeah, I think it's totally a legitimate concern, because MRIs, has taken on sort of this mythical quality in among patients that MRI sees all, and MRI sees a lot, and that can be a bad thing sometimes, and that it doesn't necessarily give you an answer. It may see something, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what it is. It tells you what it might be potentially, and then you have to go chasing it. So I think that's definitely a concern. Hopefully, as this becomes more commonplace, we'll do better and better at separating the signal from the noise with whole body MRI, with comprehensive lab testing. The argument, and this is part of what kind of changed my mind on it, is that should we not take advantage of this because there's the possibility of incidentalomas or chasing things? No, I mean, I think there's still a place for, hey, let's learn, let's maybe do it better over time. I think we still have an obligation to make sure we're not causing harm by overtesting or leading to more interventions and things like that. And I think that still is to be determined, but it doesn't mean that there's not a place for figuring that out.
Value-based care in theory sounds amazing, right? You pay for outcomes, you pay for helping patients long term. We all know outcomes are mostly driven by socioeconomic status, by gender, by race, and healthcare maybe contributes 20% to your outcomes. So how do we design a value-based system which, isn't just, okay, I'll just take care of, rich old white men, right? Because that's the group that's more likely to do the best. And people who can afford the treatment I offer are people who will more likely benefit from it. So, like, how do we design a value-based care system which deals with a confounding variable that people who have more money to afford the best treatments are likely to have the best outcomes?
Yeah, so you're sort of hinting at cherry picking and lemon dropping, which is one of the biggest criticisms, valid criticisms of value-based care. We went into the CMS BPCI-A program, which was for hip and knee replacements. It was voluntary, but we felt like we were doing a good enough job taking care of those patients that we would have success in the program, and we did. I tried not to change too much of what I was doing because before we went into the program, I tried to stay on top of, what's the latest and greatest in terms of treatment, and doing things that are appropriate, not sending people to nursing homes after surgery or rehabs after surgery, sending them home because the data showed that those places were associated with increased complications, higher readmission rates. The data showed that most people were safer going home into their own environment. And trying to eliminate some of those low value treatments that drove up costs. So, we still optimized patients for surgery. We didn't say, no, you can't have surgery. We said, you're going to have surgery, but let's do some things first to get you healthier. And I think that was a good thing to get people healthier before surgery and reduce their risk of complications. If they were able to get there, then we operated on them. I think going forward, there has to be more sophistication in terms of how you risk stratify things, to make sure that you're not disincentivizing treatment for more complex populations. I mean, they seem to be able to do some form of risk stratification for Medicare Advantage here, so I don't see why we couldn't do that for, other forms of value-based care. So I think we just have to be a little bit more sophisticated with our models. Doesn't mean we have to make them more complicated necessarily. I think we need to make them, simpler, but also have a reasonable risk stratification mechanism.
This is a somewhat different question, although I assume it's parallel. What are your thoughts on universal basic income?
Yeah, that's not something I have spent a ton of time thinking about. I think there's merits to it. There's pros and cons on both sides. I think it's something we'll hear more about, with AI. If AI is going to take everybody's job and there's no jobs left, how do people live? Is it through, universal basic income? I mean, I think having a certain standard of living for people, either you have to increase the minimum wage so that people that are working hard are able to live. I mean, you shouldn't work a 40-hour a week job or multiple jobs and still not be able to live. So whether that's increasing minimum wage or universal basic income, I think ultimately that lifts everybody up and ties back to the idea that healthcare is deeply tied into social factors and things like that. So if we can get people, living better, that's a solution I don't think is talked about enough in terms of solving healthcare. Because, we always talk about how America has this, terrible healthcare system and the outcomes. It's not that the outcomes are bad. It's that there's so many social factors, access to care, access to mental health resources, access to income. So we don't have, violent deaths. We don't have people that are, kind of forced to make poor health choices because that's really all they can do.
Why did you do an MBA, and is it something you'd recommend to physicians?
I did it because as I got more involved in the entrepreneurship, investing, and even in my practice, I became a part owner in a surgery center. We ex ended up pursuing a private equity sale of our practice. I wanted to understand the language of business better. I didn't expect to walk into a Fortune 500 company and take over, but it was more, what does EBITDA mean? What's a P&L statement? What are leadership types? What is marketing? What are market for? All these things, just to try to understand them better. I did an online MBA. It was self-paced. It was very reasonably priced. I wasn't going to spend, six figures and take 6 months to a year out of my practice to go do it. I worked it into, my practice because it was self-paced and it was very reasonably priced. And I got out of it what I wanted to get out of it. I think if you go into an MBA thinking that getting that degree is going to magically just open doors for you, I think that's a mistaken notion. I don't think it's necessarily going to pry open a bunch of doors. And I worry a little bit that, as you talked about, if you have doctors that are sort of running away, that they feel like an MBA is going to be the thing that gives them that landing spot. I don't think that that's necessarily the case. Now, if you go to Harvard Business School or you go to Stanford GSB, you go to MIT, and you go to those programs, that'll probably, at least you can network, you'll have good networking opportunities. It might open some doors for you, but you're going to spend a lot of money and a lot of time doing that.
How have your startup investments gone, and what was your diligence thesis or criteria?
So far, let's see, it's maybe 4 or 5 years into it. It's been a mixed bag. So I think I've had my first official exit as an angel investor. The company got acquired. I got nothing because I was an early angel investor. They raised money, quite a bit of money, and then had a significant down round. My shares, I didn't put in more money, so my preferred shares got converted to common stock. And then once they sold, because they were, underwater with the waterfalls, I ended up with nothing. So it was an interesting experience, but that didn't do so well. I've had a couple of others that flamed out. So I think I've made 10 investments so far. So, one exit where I got nothing, two that folded, the rest are still going. And the ones that are still going I seem to be doing fairly well. I have another company that looks like it's on the verge of being acquired, and I probably will see some return on investment on that one. So that'll be my first win. So I got some stock options. I wrote articles for Doximity. So Doximity has the OpMed Fellows program, and I wrote a series of articles for them, and they paid you in stock options. And I was fortunate enough to get my stock options right before Doximity went public, and they were kind enough to double the stock options for us right before it went public. So yeah, it wasn't a huge amount of money, but it was a decent win. And then I did some advising for another company that's well known in the digital health MSK space that will probably go public, I would guess, in the next year or two. I got some stock options or some options for doing that consulting work, and I exercised those options, and they've had a couple of buybacks, so to speak. And so I've been able to cash in some of those. So, I guess I've had more success with my advisor shares than I have with my direct angel investments so far.
And what was your criteria, for the startups you picked?
Yeah, the criteria was initially, is it something I feel like I can add value to and learn from? Was initially my criteria. And then the criteria kind of became, was it something I believe in that's, fixing a real problem? And then the criteria kind of became, do I believe in this founder? Does this person, seem to have a clear vision? Do they seem to be, driven? So it was, and then it became kind of a combination of those things. So more of a, gut feel. I can't tell you I did a lot of, high level VC level due diligence. And I never put in a ton of money. I kind of, spread it out, small investments here or there. But it was just a, really a gut feel.
What is something technical builders get wrong about healthcare?
There's a lot in healthcare, I think, from the outside, and I think you'd probably agree that seems intuitive from the outside, but when you're in it, it's sort of counterintuitive, and you don't understand. Like somebody was tweeting recently about being frustrated about being on the wait list to be seen in a specialty clinic, and their appointment was a couple of months out. And they asked to be on a wait list for the appointment, and then they happened to call up about something else and happened to just ask the person they talked to, and were able to get in the next day. So it's like, how is this broken that they have this wait list, and I was on this wait list for 2 months, and I just happened to randomly call up and got in the next day. And the reality is that scheduling is very complex, and it seems like it's an easy thing. I have a wait list. Somebody, something opens up, and somebody's going to get off the wait list. But there's so much that goes on behind the scenes in terms of how you manage, clinic appointments, and somebody canceling their appointment at the last minute, and then somebody having to go through the wait list and call people, and maybe the first three people you call don't pick up, or they can't come in. And now that person who's probably doing five other jobs is now we having to spend time doing that, as opposed to it's just easier if somebody calls up that day and an appointment pops up that day. It's just easier to slot that person in than go through, track down a wait list, things like that. I mean, I think there's things that happen behind the scenes that are more complex that seem, more straightforward from the outside. But then when you're in it and you've experienced, you realize there are things that maybe you're not considering that make it more complex. I'm not saying that's right. I'm not saying there aren't ways to make it less complex, but as it exists now, I think there's a complexity to even some of the things that seem really straightforward, that people don't necessarily understand. A lot of it has to do with, workflows and back office functions and things like that.
What is the role of robotics and AI in ortho, and what are you excited about for the future of ortho?
So we've had a lot of robotics in ortho. I call it the robot wars. And so there's robotic hip and knee replacement that's really taken off. It's become more and more prevalent, and I've done that in my career. If you look at the data, the data isn't quite there yet in terms of superiority of robotics. And like a lot of things in healthcare, you have your camps. People in a robotic camp that say it's clearly better, and people in a non-robotic camp that say it's not, and it's too expensive, and it's, blindly trusting technology. I think the potential is certainly there. I think we have to get more sophisticated with it. I think we have to learn how to use the robot better as a tool. So I think, now the robots have been around for, I think 10 years at least, and we're gathering more data, and we can look at that data, and we can become better with the robots based on what we're data that we're gathering. And I think robotics will continue to become higher and higher yield and eventually be proven to be superior probably to non-robotics. So I think AI will help us get there by taking in, large amounts of data, unstructured data, structured data, parsing through it and helping us figure out how best to use the robots and really personalize care. I think that's part of the challenge that we have, particularly in hip and knee replacements, is classically you're taught to kind of do it the same for everybody, but in reality, people's anatomy is different. We just don't know how it's different from one person to the next and how you tailor it from one person to the next. So you kind of treat everybody the same way, and you're going to capture 80%, 90%, 75% of people doing it the same for everybody. But you're going to have that 10 to 20% who, don't need the standard hip or knee replacement, need something a little bit different. And we just don't have great tools to identify who those people are. And then even if we do identify them, what they do need. So I think robotics and AI are going to help us there. I think the other big thing with AI is being able to tailor like non-surgical treatment or, figure out what the best treatment is for that particular individual and be a little bit more personalized in terms of our treatments.
Do you think AI will replace the family physician? And then do you think AI will replace the orthopedic surgeon? And if it does, which one will happen first?
Yeah, that's the hot button topic. I think The AI models will get better and better. It's very hard right now to, I think, parse through, what's real and what's hype in terms of, you pass USMLE or you pass this test, you pass that test. Well, I think people overestimate how much the sort of the diagnosis issue plays into things in healthcare. At least for orthopedics, a diagnosis isn't usually all that confusing, or the diagnosis part of it isn't necessarily the hard part of it. A lot of the hard part of it is, talking through with the patient what the problem is, what the solutions are, choosing the right solution, what to do if the patient chooses a low value solution, or what to do if the patient doesn't, agree with the treatment recommendation. And I'm not sure that that's, is that something AI is going to resolve? Is it something AI can't resolve? I think a lot of the companies that are pushing AI solutions don't want to, be responsible for that, discussion, that decision making. So, I mean, to get back to the original question, I think AI tools will help, but I think there's still the human element of medicine that people underestimate, that AI can seem empathetic, but at the end of the day, how far is a patient going to be willing to go back and forth with the AI before they want somebody to, really discuss with them, or give them, a little bit of a more less prescriptive answer, I guess, for lack of a better term. Will AI replace family physicians or orthopedic surgeons first? I think there's definitely a future where robots are able to do a hip or a knee replacement without the surgeon needing to touch the robot. I think there are already companies working on that. Once the robot still has to learn how to do the exposure, maybe someday they'll learn how to do that. But you may replace a surgeon with just a technician who doesn't go through a full training, but just kind of monitors the robot. Don't think we're there yet. I think that's going to take a long time. I think it'll take time for patients to trust that. So if, and I think this is a big if, AI is going to replace somebody, it's probably going to be the so-called cognitive specialties before the surgical procedural specialties. But I think we're a long way off from both of those things. And I think people also overestimate the degree to which patients want that. I think there's still a large amount of skepticism and distrust towards AI that gets discounted in the circles that we sort of, run in, because there's a lot of interest, and we kind of end up in this echo chamber, these small spheres of innovators, health tech people, entrepreneurs, investors that are really bullish on AI and healthcare. But if you look at the studies that come out, patients like AI until they figure out it's AI, and then they don't like it so much. And so I think we're still underestimating the degree to which the demand on the part of patients is there. There's definitely a subset of people that are very frustrated with traditional healthcare and would go to an AI, chatbot or whatever in a minute, because they're so fed up with the traditional system. And I think they, maybe get a little bit more attention than the 60, 70, 80% of other people that still want human interaction.
Yeah, I love talking to AI, Gemini, ChatGPT, and AI agents as well. They always tell me how brilliant I am. You know,
That's
I
the, yeah,
do. Yeah.
that's the other part, right? They're very they're and they're made that way, right? They're made to be affirming. They're made to sort of be, not necessarily sycophantic, although obviously ChatGPT 4.0 kind of tipped over in that direction. But yeah, I mean, the more you talk with it, the more great you become. And what's yeah, and again, the models can be tuned in different ways, but it's a little bit, disturbing that you can kind of lead the witness. And if you talk to ChatGPT or Gemini long enough, eventually they'll start to, tell you what you want to hear. They'll just basically echo back to you what you're suggesting to them. And that can be very dangerous in healthcare. It can lead to, poor decisions that seem like the right decision.
Do you think that's good for our mental health?
Chatbots and AI.
Yeah.
I think it can be, but I think it can, just like social media, it can be, but it can very quickly become not so good for your mental health. I mean, there were, stories that were coming out there, the revolt against GPT-5, and people were very upset that GPT-4.0 went away because they had bonded with it, and people were, so upset they were crying. I think that that's probably not the best thing. And so I think, like any tool that gives you that feedback, and it probably is giving you the same dopamine hit that, social media gives you, and maybe even worse, because you can kind of tune it to give you the dopamine hits that you want. Yeah, I think that's dangerous.
And why is it dangerous?
Well, I think it's dangerous because you kind of get sucked into that world the same way you can get sucked into social media and kind of lose track of, what is reality, to lose track of being grounded and start to, believe things that aren't necessarily true, or get, the same thing as you can go down a rabbit hole with, social media of being fed things that seem like they're true but aren't. I think there's the risk with AI that it's telling you how great you are, but maybe you aren't really that great, or maybe there are things that you need to, fix or be aware of, and it's sort of, telling you that, justifying that, no, you're right and everybody else is wrong, when maybe you aren't right.
Do you, and so my listeners will be used to this, but let's go a little bit deeper here. Do you think ignorance is bliss? And if so, if someone tells you you're right, even if you're not, and gives you constant validation, and you fall in love with a robot like her, should we deny that for you if that will lead to happiness? Is happiness the objective, or is the objective reaching the truth? And if it's the latter, why is that? Why isn't happiness subjective?
Yeah, I think, we would love for ignorance to be bliss because facing the truth is painful, but I think there is, danger in the ignorance is bliss, because how long can that continue? At some point you may have to face the truth whether you want to or not, and I think that that can be very painful. I think there's very much a parallel in medicine, and I think that's why it's going to be hard to have AI replace humans in healthcare. Because if the AI, let's say somebody comes in, they have knee arthritis, and they, get an MRI, they have a meniscus tear, and their neighbor had a knee scope, and they really want a knee scope, and I sit there and tell them, look, you're past the point of a knee scope. The really, it's either knee replacement or, non-operative treatment, but that patient's adamant that they want a knee scope, and I know that that is, low value treatment. At what point does ignorance, it's not my job to hide the truth from them and just say, you know what, this person wants that knee scope. I know it's not the best option for them. I know they're probably going to do worse with that, but ignorance is bliss for that patient. If they don't know that going into it, no harm, no foul. But eventually they're going to find out afterwards that, ignorance is not bliss. So, it's, yes, it would be a lot easier to just go along with it and say, you know what, have that surgery, even if I know that surgery is unlikely to help you. That's the path of least resistance, rather than, the truth, which is more painful, that, less invasive surgery, that's not a, painful long recovery knee replacement, is not going to help you. So I think, ignorance is bliss until it isn't. And sometimes you have to face those hard truths, and that's, part of medicine, and I think it's part of life.
Do you think this is something founders and non-founders who don't have a healthcare background, building in medicine, get wrong? That they just want to maximize Prasgany scores or patient satisfaction scores in surveys, and they know the way to maximize is give the patient what they request, what they want, not what they need.
Yeah, I think it's dangerous. And I think there, I get, I don't want to say battles, but disagreements sometimes on social media about this, of, this idea of consumerization in healthcare, right? If you're treating the patient as a customer and you take the idea in business that the customer is always right, then, the patient is going to come in and dictate care. Now, I don't think it should be a paternalistic model. I think shared decision making, is the right model. It shouldn't be me as a doctor telling the patient, what the treatment's going to be. But I think the flip side of that is the patient dictating treatment. Look, if we want a healthcare system, if we say we want value-based care, or we say we want evidence-based care, or we say we want, high-value care, you can't slam doctors for offering low-value treatments because they get paid for it. At the same time, slam doctors for, gatekeeping care or being paternalistic. You have to find that middle ground between the two of those things. And I think that is something that gets overlooked. And the most difficult conversations I had throughout my career were the ones where a person, was really adamant that they wanted surgery, which I get, paid more to do, right? I mean, if somebody says, I want surgery, and I'm just the fee for service, surgeon that wants to get paid, sure. Even if I don't think that surgery is indicated, okay, it's very easy. Sure, I'll sign you up for surgery if you want surgery. That's not always the right thing to do. And those are the difficult conversations too, but it's incumbent on me to explain the rationale why that is. But at the same time, I, in my judgment, am trying to, prevent a bad outcome, and do what, in my experience, in my judgment, or at least explain to the patient what, in my best judgment, is the right course of action. And then it becomes, is the argument, well, it doesn't matter what you want, doctor. If the patient wants the surgery, the patient should have the surgery. How do we reconcile that? And I think that gets overlooked a lot of the time of, well, it's just doctors gatekeeping. You don't want me to have this. You don't want me to have that. But there is, sometimes a reason behind that. Again, it's incumbent on me to explain that rationale and to, engender enough trust in the patient that they at least take what I have to say to heart. They may not follow it, and that's, it's not up to me to, be prescriptive to them. They should have the autonomy and the agency to make those decisions. But I think, at the end of the day, the customer is always right is not the best way to practice healthcare.
If there's a system where, we're operating healthcare as a buffet or a McDonald's drive-through, and patients get to pick what they want, say they get to pick they want surgery, and if you're operating in that system, you have to provide it, even though you know it may actually lead to net harm for this patient and for this situation. If that system exists, should we also build a parallel liability legal system which allows the patient to assume full liability, and they can sign off their right to sue? Because currently in the current system they can't do that, right? Even
Right.
if you do what the patient wants against your better judgment, if there's a negative outcome, the patient can still sue you. And no amount of notes that I told them so, that's not going to protect you because you still performed the surgery. So how are you going to look at the liability framework shifting? And the one analogy is, if there's an AI pilot flying the plane for a cheaper fare, should patients be allowed to sign off liability? The answer there, I think, is clearly no, because the risk is too high and there's a big information asymmetry,
Right.
right? But patients have no idea how to fly a plane unless you're a
Right.
pilot. It's just so your patients have no idea how to do a joint replacement unless they're an orthopedic surgeon. So I think, how do you think about liability in this framework?
Yeah, I mean, I think even in that situation, you could probably still argue that the patient can inform themselves, and many patients do, are very informed. They have more tools now than they've ever had to inform themselves. I'd like to think that the whatever 14 years I spent, getting to the through training, and then the 17 years I spent in my career, taught me enough experience that, even all the reading in the world, all the educating yourself in the world, isn't a substitute for, having experienced it multiple patients over many years. So, can a patient ever fully understand the risks? I think a lot of them would argue yes, and I can see, a lot of them rolling their eyes at me right now and saying, doctor, it's my decision. I can educate myself, and you don't know what you're talking about. I don't know. I mean, I think if you looked at other, pilots flying a plane, any other type of profession where it's, you go through a training process that's rigorous, I don't think that, I would never walk onto a plane after, researching how to fly a plane and think that I could fly a plane. I would never, go to a restaurant, a fancy restaurant. I think I could go in the kitchen and make meals for everybody. Not to trivialize it, but I think that can you ever really make a fully informed enough decision to take on that liability? Is that the right thing to do? And I don't think it's necessarily the right thing to do.
What is a common misconception about ortho? There's a lot of ortho jokes, right? Like, what is a stethoscope? And
Right.
I don't hear the bone and things like that. What's a more serious common misconception? And what advice do you have for medical students who are thinking about orthopedic surgery as a residency?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of misconceptions. I'll go, more high level and low level. So I think the high level misconception, is that sort of Neanderthal orthopedic surgeon. I'm not sure I could get an orthopedic surgery residency spot in this day and age because they're so competitive, and Even back in my day, you kind of had to be at the top of your class and do well on the standardized testing to get a spot. Now I think the average number of publications for an orthopedic, resident or somebody, a medical student applying to orthopedics is like 10 publications or something like ridiculous like that. I was doing research wasn't even on my radar screen in medical school. Now you can't get a spot unless you've done a lot of research. I think there's good things and bad things about that. I think it sort of leads to maybe low quality research and this pressure to, publish papers. But I guess the misconception would be that orthopedic surgeons are just kind of, Neanderthals that carry hammers around. The lower level misconception, we get chastised or the misconception of the orthopedics is just all about the money. It's all about how many procedures can I do. It's all about the financial part of it. We are well paid. We are typically at the top of the reimbursement list here in the US. I would argue it's in part because we are entrepreneurial. We are tend to be more fiercely independent than some other specialties. We do have the ability to take advantage of ancillary services like PT and MRI and owning ASCs that sort of are complementary to what we do in our day-to-day. I think that we have gotten, more efficient and changed with the times. The average Medicare reimbursement for a total joint now is I think by 2026 is going to be less than $1,200, to the surgeon for a hip or a knee replacement from Medicare. And that's, when you adjust for inflation down over 80% compared to it was, 20 years ago, and you say, oh, well, you've just done more unnecessary surgeries. Well, at the same time, we have this population that's aging. We have this demand for joint replacements that's going up as the baby boomers age. We also have the second population of younger people that are getting arthritis at an earlier age. So there really is no need to do unnecessary joint replacements at this point. We've just become extremely efficient at it. Patients are getting more complex, but our outcomes are the same, if not better, than they were, when patients were healthier. So, I think people underestimate. You say, oh, you just do more, you do more surgeries. Well, the surgeries have to be done. You don't just, wave your hand. It's still, work to get it done. So I think that we get dinged sometimes for, sort of being just, money focused and doing unnecessary surgeries. That happens for sure. I mean, I'm not here to say that doesn't happen in some cases, but I don't think it's as frequent as people make it out to be.
Last question. What advice do you have for 35-year-old Ben, if you can go back in time and talk to him?
So let's see, 35-year-old Ben. So, 13 years ago, where was I 13 years ago? I was still early on in my career. I would say, just give yourself more grace. Don't be so hard on yourself. Don't be, I mean, I think perfection should always be the goal. I think back then, I didn't understand that perfection is a fool's errand in healthcare and as a surgeon. To give yourself a little bit of grace when you don't reach perfection, and it's always going to eat at you, but you can't let it consume you. You have to learn from it. You have to learn from your mistakes. You have to get better, but you also have to, not overlook your wins and focus too much on the losses. I think there's a tendency, particularly, in high achieving people, to over-index on the losses and not give yourself enough credit for the wins.
I'll ask one more question. So I'm 39, entering 40 fairly soon in January. But my 30s have been more or less a blur, right? It feels like I was 29 yesterday, mentally, physically less so. What advice do you have for someone? And I'm doing four or five different things with my career, partly because I don't know what to do still. And partly because some things bring in money and some things I do for enjoyment. What advice do you have for someone who's just entering their 40s?
Yeah, I think take time to slow down and enjoy the journey. Because, when you're really young, you feel physically, invulnerable. And then you're also just sort of, learning your way through things. When you're in your 30s, you still feel physically, pretty good. You're starting to establish yourself. But things are still pretty fresh and you're not necessarily thinking about the long term at that point. I think as you get into your 40s, particularly towards later on in your 40s, I think you start to, think more about, work-life balance and not go all the time, but appreciate the journey, appreciate, the people around you, your family, appreciate the small moments, that you can't go all the time, because, you start to realize that, you're not going to be here forever, and you don't want to look back on it and regret not spending more time doing these things. I mean, I'm sure you do it for your family the same way that I do it for my family, but at the same time, they want you there. They appreciate the work that you do, but they also, want you present. And so it's about finding that right balance and realizing that, you only have so much time.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us today, Ben.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, appreciate it.